everybody, and welcome to another beautiful Thursday morning. You're listening to Bhavani at IE Green on the Progressive Radio Network. And I have a great show planned for you today. I'm so excited to have as my guest Holly Hughes, who is the food editor of a group of books called The Best Food Writing. This latest one is Best Food Writing 2016, and Holly has been writing these. She has written 18 editions so far and counting. And I'm really excited to have her on. I'll tell you more about her in a little bit when she comes on the show. But first, of course, I want to share with you some things going on in and around the city and some things that are in the news and my weekly recipe. So first, you know, one of the biggest things in the news is coming up this weekend. It's the Climate March, which is set to be a huge event in Washington, D.C. Last weekend was the March for Science, which was an amazing event. Hundreds of thousands of people were in Washington, D.C., and there were sister marches all across the country. And this weekend is set to be really big as well. Unfortunately, there is not a march in New York City. They were planning one, and it got canceled. I think they're trying to encourage everybody to go to Washington, D.C. So there are some smaller sister marches that have popped up. I know there's one in Astoria, one on Staten Island, one in Long Beach. I heard of one being formed out in Port Jefferson. So you can go to the People's Climate March website and find out about a march near you if you can't get to Washington, D.C. But it is really important that we all take to the streets. I mean, climate change is coming, and right now we have an administration that is filled with climate change deniers, and we really need to raise the ante. We need to all get to the streets and let our government officials know that the people care, and the people, we can't raise as much money as they have there in Washington or as the big corporations have who are fighting against climate change, or not against climate change, who are denying that climate change is happening. But what we do have is the numbers of people. We can outnumber them easily, and we really need to show that support. And so we need to all take to the streets to do that. And this weekend is going to be a big one on Saturday. There's lots of other things going on as well. So if you can't make it to the People's Climate March, there is also an International World Soup Disco Day on April 29th, which I just found out about. It's being sponsored by Slow Food, and I run our local Slow Food chapter, and I wish I had known, because although it would be in conflict with the climate march, I don't know if I actually would have done it. But there is a Soup Disco Day being sponsored by Slow Food Metro North. So if you are in the Westchester area, it's taking place in South Salem. And you can go to the Slow Food Metro North website or Facebook page to find out about it. But Soup Disco Day actually started 7 years ago in Berlin, and it's addressing food waste. And food waste has been in the news a lot. It's an issue that is actually solvable as more people become aware of it. But there's lots of different nonprofits popping up that are collecting food waste from farmers and restaurants and grocers and trying to redistribute it to people that are hungry. But Food Disco Day, what they do is they collect all the food locally from farmers and grocers and the like and bring it to a common place where there's space for dancing and access to electricity. And they cook up some big pots of soup. And you set up tables, and lots of people volunteer cutting and chopping up the vegetables. And it's kind of like stone soup. You know, everyone brings what they can. But in this case, we're collecting food. And they, in the first one in Berlin, I think, fed 5,000 people. It was a big happening, and people are dancing and cooking. And there was a big event in in New York City. They also were in California and Washington collecting food waste and serving that up at Union Square when we were in New York. So there's, like I said, lots of organizations that are really addressing food waste. I was at the Tribeca Film Festival Tuesday night watching a great film called Intent to Destroy, which was a documentary actually that was made about the Armenian Holocaust that, you know, is being denied, and it really was a documentary about the making of the film The Promise, which if you haven't seen yet is really worth getting to the theaters to see. But at the Tribeca Film Festival, there are films on food, and one of them is on food waste that looks like a great film. I'm going to try to get to it if I can. It is called The Story of Food Waste, and it's directed by Anna Chai and Nari Kai. And it should be a great film. But anyway, food waste is an issue that is close to my heart and most people who are involved with food justice issues are really paying a lot of attention to food waste. So anyway, Soup Disco Day is trying to address that and having fun at the same time. Just to backtrack a little bit, tonight is an orientation and training meeting for the Resisting the Spectre pipeline, which is a high-pressured shale gas pipeline that is traveling up the coast of New Jersey, crossing over through Staten Island and coming into Manhattan on the lower part of Manhattan, right by, I guess, the Verrazano Bridge area. Anyway, it's crossing over the Hudson. Pipelines always leak. There is, you know, an explosion up in Harlem not that long ago that killed 7 people from an 8-inch gas pipeline. This one is going to be 30 to 42 inches. It's a huge gas pipeline right in Manhattan. It's bringing shale gas that we don't need, and it is, you know, risking people's lives. These pipelines are just going everywhere. We have protested the Keystone Pipeline. We've been protesting at Standing Rock. This is one right in our backyards, and we need to protest it. So tonight there is a training and orientation meeting at the Association Neighborhood and Housing Development on Broad Street in New York City from 6 to 9. 6:30 to 9, so if you can make it, that's really a great thing to do. Information that I'm talking about right now can all be found on my website, so there is a link where you can RSVP on my website or a phone number to get more information if you are interested in that. Also tonight, there's a fundraiser for Food Tank, which is a great nonprofit organization trying to educate and spread the word about food injustice. And they're a great organization. They're having a fundraiser tonight at the Highline Ballroom from 6 to 7:30, and it's a dancing fundraiser. So it's a fitness concept to raise money, and it should be a lot of fun. Suggested donations, $40. And then what else is going on? May 2nd, The Power of a Plant. This is a launch party of Stephen Ritz's new book, called The Power of a Plant. Steve Ritz runs the Green Bronx Machine. He's a powerhouse. If you have not seen him speak, look up his TED Talk. He's just amazing. And this is a fundraiser, actually, for the book, but also to promote the work he's doing up in the Bronx, growing gardens and teaching kids about where their food comes from. He's just doing amazing work. So check out his TEDx talk. And if you are around in the city on May 2nd, come to this launch party. Also, May 4th, Sustainable Malloy. Malloy College out here on Long Island has a sustainability program. And once a month or every other month, they have a film series. And the one coming up is called Plastic Paradise. And it's free if you don't have any money. There's a $5 suggested donation, and it includes a vegan dinner. It's out at the Malloy College's location out by in Farmingdale, out by the airport out there. But you can go to Sustainable Institute at Malloy College and find out exactly how to get there if you're interested. This next weekend also is Riverkeepers Hudson Sweep. Riverkeeper is a wonderful organization promoting the cleaning up of the Hudson River. And this is an annual event where people come together and participate in cleaning up different shorelines along the Hudson River. So you can find out a location near you and join in that. Lots more events on my website, so check them out. Oh, I do want to mention May 10th is the River Fund's Spring Shindig. It's a fundraiser. And the River Fund is the organization that I partner with every Thanksgiving and Christmas when we cook for 1,000 people and feed the homeless out on the streets at Rufus King Park. And the River Fund is a wonderful food pantry. They are serving more families than I think any other food pantry in the city. And they have a great program called From Cradle to College. And they realize that poverty really starts, you know, I mean, it's ingrained in the families, and it starts with the youngest, and the only way to really get out of poverty is through education. And so they really support young families from the very beginning when they're having their kids, helping them with school, helping them with homework, all the way to college. And when I went to their last fundraiser, they had a great video clip about, you know, how many people who are poor who start college don't finish. And the reason is not because they don't have the scholarships to get through. They do have the scholarships, but they're missing just a few hundred dollars to pay for their books or their food or their lodging, because most scholarships don't cover books and food. And it's just a few hundred dollars can make the difference between someone finishing college and not. So they're having this fundraiser. If you can make it, they're a great organization. Check them out, the River Fund New York. And this one is at the penthouse at Dream Downtown on West 16th Street. And again, it's May 10th from 7 to 10:30. I will definitely be there, and I hope to see many of you there. I would like to now share my recipe with all of you. It's a tofu vegetable marbella. Now, I've been making a chicken marbella dish for years. I've never tasted it because I don't eat chicken, but it's out of the Silver Palette Cookbook, and, you know, people have loved it. It was passed on to me as a really great, easy recipe to make for large groups when I'm cooking for large groups who eat that. And I've been making it for years, and I've always wanted to make a vegetarian option, a vegan vegetarian option. And I just did, and it came out great. So I'm really happy to say I now have tasted marbella. So this is a tofu vegetable marbella. Of course, I add lots of vegetables to it. It's not just the tofu. So these are the ingredients that you need. Start with 2 pounds of tofu, so basically two blocks. Sometimes they're 15 ounces, sometimes they're 14 ounces, sometimes they're a full 16 ounces. Whatever, just get two blocks of super firm tofu. I usually look for sprouted tofu because I think it's a little healthier, but get extra firm because it will really hold the shape. 2 tablespoons chopped garlic, 2 tablespoons oregano, 2 tablespoons olive oil, 1/2 teaspoon salt, 1/4 teaspoon pepper. Then you also need 1/4 cup of red wine vinegar, 1/4 cup of prunes, 1/4 cup of green Spanish olives, 1/4 cup of capers with juice, 1/4 cup of white wine, 1 cup of fire roasted tomatoes, 4 bay leaves, 1/4 cup of brown sugar, 2 tablespoons of Italian parsley, and that's for the tofu portion. And then for the stir fry part, you need 1 onion cut into slivers, 1 bunch of asparagus, bottoms trimmed off and cut into 1-inch pieces. And when I cut the asparagus, I always like to cut it on an angle. It just looks better in the stir fry. So if you can do that, do that. 1 head of broccoli cut into florets. 1 bunch of kale, the large stems removed and then chopped up. 1/4 cup of white wine again. 1 8-ounce pack of baby portobello mushrooms, and you can substitute any mushrooms that you have. 2 cups of rainbow carrots, cut julienne. And again, you can substitute any carrots you have. I just happened to find this little bag of rainbow carrots, and I use that. 1 red pepper cut in half and then into strips. 2 tablespoons of chopped garlic, 2 tablespoons oregano, 1/2 teaspoon salt, 1/4 teaspoon pepper, and 2 tablespoons of Italian parsley chopped. So you're going to start by cutting the tofu into the block crosswise into thirds, and then lay it out on a clean dish towel and press down to try to remove the water. Then cut it into cubes and put it into a large bowl. And in a separate bowl, make a marinade with the garlic, the olive oil, the oregano, the salt and pepper, and toss that over the tofu. And just let that, stir that up so it's all coated. And then on a large cookie sheet with parchment paper, line it with parchment paper. You're going to bake the tofu at a high heat. I cooked mine at 450 degrees until golden brown. About approximately 20 minutes, but halfway through I pulled it out and I turned the tofu over so that all the sides got golden brown. And in a separate mold bowl, I made another marinade with the vinegar, the prunes, the olives, the capers, the fire-roasted tomatoes, the white wine, and the bay leaves. And when the tofu came out, I poured this marinade over the tofu, covered it, and I let that marinate for a few hours. In the actual original recipe of the chicken marbella, they actually marinate it overnight in the refrigerator, and if I had had the time, I probably would have loved to do that. So if you have the time to do this part and let it marinate overnight in the refrigerator, it will just give it that much more flavor. But I marinated for 2 hours, and then before cooking it, I sprinkled it with the brown sugar, and I baked it at 350 oven for 20 minutes until it was ready. And for the vegetables, while the tofu is baking at that last part, I started the stir fry. And so I first covered the bottom of my wok with some olive oil. And when that was hot, I added the onions and cooked those for a few minutes. Then I added the carrots and the garlic. And as I say all the time, when you're stir frying, you start with the vegetables that take the longest to cook. So those are usually the root vegetables. So if I also had rutabaga in there, I'd be using it, or turnips or radishes. I might put that in at the beginning. So you're going to stir fry that for a few minutes. Then you're going to add the kale, one handful of at a time so it can cook down, because it's too much to go in all at once. Cook it down, and then once the kale is cooked down, you can add the mushrooms and cook those for another 5 minutes or so. Then add the broccoli and cook that for a few minutes before adding the red pepper, the asparagus, and the oregano. And the peppers and the asparagus cook up really quickly. So just cook those for about 3 minutes. Add the salt, pepper, and taste it. And you also can add a little white wine to this, and that will just help steam all the vegetables together. You're going to lay that out on a platter, and then when you take the tofu out of the oven, you're going to lay the tofu on top so that it looks really pretty. You can serve this with rice, with noodles, whatever side dish you'd like. Garnish the whole thing with some fresh chopped parsley, and that is it. It's beautiful. It's delicious. It sounds like it's a lot of work, but it's really not. Most of the items we all have sitting right in our pantry, so I just had to gather them from the pantry. Most of them I didn't have to go out and buy. And that's one of the things I talk about a lot, is having a really good stocked pantry really helps you so much when you do want to create recipes. If you had to really go out and buy everything each time, it would be difficult. So anyway, enjoy that. And as always, let me know how you like it. I love feedback. So now it's my pleasure to introduce my guest today, Holly Hughes. She is the founder and editor of 18 editions and counting of the annual Best Food Writing Anthology. And it is, as I can imagine, a great job. She loves her work. She gets to read all this great writing and then put it together in these beautiful books. Prior to this, she worked as the executive editor of Fodor's Travel Publications. She also did 12 travel guides with Frommer's and has authored 13 novels for adolescent girls. She also blogs about rock music at www.thesonginmyheadtoday.blogspot.com. And Holly's been living in New York since 1978, and I'm so thrilled to have her on with me. Holly, are you with me?
Yes, I'm here.
Hi, thank you so much for joining me today.
I'm glad to be here on this lovely rainy day.
Yes, I know. So I am looking through this book, and I am just loving it. What a great job you have. I'm jealous.
It is fun.
Yes, well, how long have you been writing
the other
book?
Day, how many pieces I read every year. in order to select the 40 to 50 that I include in one edition. And I thought, you know, I probably look at about 1,000 pieces of food writing a year, but I can't say that I read all of them all the way through because, you know, when it's really good and you know that it's worth being in the book, you know it very quickly.
Right.
But when it's not, you also know it very quickly.
Uh-huh. How do you know it? What kind of things do you look for in food writing?
Oh, for years I've said that the three criteria I have is it either has to make me laugh or it has to make me cry or it has to make me hungry. But I also realize that what I'm looking for is good storytelling, which is, you know, the basis of any good essay, is that it begins in one place and takes you on a journey to some place and you think differently at the end of it. So I think most of these pieces pretty much fit that category.
Mm-hmm. And how did you first come up with the idea of doing this?
You know, when I was at Fodor's and I was editing travel guides, I was always the section of a book I was always most interested in was the dining reviews. And when I started writing my own, I found I was spending much more time picking restaurants and trying to craft somebody's experience through the restaurants they were going to than even through the sightseeing. So when somebody else mentioned to me that his wife loved to read cookbooks in bed without, you know, on her bedside table and didn't even bother ever cooking from it, just that reading cookbooks was fun, I think between us we cooked up this idea. And it was probably just the perfect time because in the year 2000 when we started, you know, dining was, you know, and recipe, you thought about dining reviews and recipe pieces, and they were kind of relegated to what had only really been started to be called the dining section. It used to be called the women's section of the newspapers. And, you know, there were a few gourmet magazines, Gourmet, Savour, Bon Appetit, Food and Wine. But a new generation was coming up and interested in food passionately in a different way. And that was just beginning. So we kind of got on this merry-go-round at the right time. And since the year 2000, the interest, the place that food takes in our general culture has just burgeoned. You know, the cooking channel is now, you know, intensely washed, and there are so many new magazines that are about food, and even general interest publications tend to have a lot more food coverage than they used to. So I think we just got in on this at the right time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I know you wrote for the Fodor's travel guides, and I have to say, you know, I travel quite a bit, and I really rely so much on those sections, as do so many people who travel. When I've traveled, you know, in Italy, and you pass a restaurant that looks packed and smells like garlic, and you go in, so often you're disappointed. But when I've gone to ones that I've gotten from the travel guides, I'm rarely disappointed.
Yeah, and you're looking for something that is of that place. You know, it's a restaurant that you'll always remember, that the food in Venice is like this, or the food in the Black Forest of Germany is like this. And, you know, you don't want to go to a safe place that's been designed for tourists. You want to eat the food of the country because that's part of your impression of the place.
Absolutely, absolutely, and it really makes a difference. And so this anthology here of all these writers is just amazing. It's so, you know, and I read a lot of food writing, and there's people in here I had never even heard of, so I'm so excited to read this. Do you think that the interest that has been peaking now in food in this culture is a passing phase, or do you really think it's a new trend that's here to stay?
I think that people who you know, became aware of food in a different way at a certain time in their lives will always be interested in food in that way. And I'll say that I still think there's two strands of interest in food writing that don't realize that they are different sides of the spectrum. But there's the trendy side, you know, people who have to shoot a picture of their dinner every time they go out to eat and put it on Instagram, and who want to know what the food of the year is and want to brag about which cool restaurants they've gone to. So that, I think of that as food as fashion. And I think that food is fashionable in a way it didn't used to be. There's a lot of young people who might have wanted to be a screenwriter in the 1960s or a rock musician, or now they want to be chefs and organic farmers. And I think that that's very interesting. They see this as more central to the culture than it used to be seen. It used to be you went and had dinner so that you could continue to do whatever else you're doing. But I think what will stick with us, even if that fashion element of food begins to fade, is the interest in food justice, the intersection between food and environmentalism, the concern about the food supply system in America and making sure that it's healthy and sustainable. There may be some faddish parts of this. You know, maybe everybody won't be doing so much fermentation in 10 years because we've explored that and we've gone about as far with that as we want. But I still think that people are going to be very concerned about the social dimensions of how our food is produced and where we're getting it from.
I agree with you. I've been involved in food most of my adult life, and I have seen it change so much. I remember when I first learned of slow food, you know, back in like 2000, I think I started to cry. I mean, I was like, oh my God, there's an organization that actually cares about food the way I care about food. And now, you know, lots of people have heard of slow food, and there's, you know, and slow food is just one of many organizations working towards food justice and with indigenous people and with, climate change and, I think people who are into food have to also care about the environment. You can't care about your food system and not care about where the food comes from. They're just so interrelated.
Absolutely. And I think that, you know, there's still a lot of input. There's a lot of dialectic about it. It used to be you could just slap the organic label on something and everyone would go, oh, yeah, that's great. Okay, it's organic. I'm going to buy that. That's better. And then as Big Ag tries to get more involved in organic foods, they're able to sort of like nip away and cut away at the authenticity of that label, and find shortcuts. And sometimes if something isn't organic, it's because it's from a small local supplier who is raising livestock humanely and trying to rotate their crops in a certain way and be more sustainable. And maybe they have to use one or two fertilizers or insecticides that aren't organic, so they can't have the label. So I think people are learning to look past that label and look at the practices of the growers in a really helpful way. And I think that there are people now who will say, I will always be willing to pay a little bit more for meat or poultry or fish and eat less of it so that I can eat better.
Right.
And instead of having a
they can eat better, and also they can support the people who are trying to make the world a better place.
Yeah. I mean, the real locavore literalists who, you know, are trying not to eat anything that's not from within 50 miles, that's a wonderful, fun orthodoxy to hew to. If you hew to it so scrupulously, you can get yourself into some crazy times when you live in the Northeast in the winter. When you say, I've eaten as many root vegetables as I can stand now. But I think that the theory of trying to support the local farmers, foods that belong in season in your region, I think that won't go away. I think people will just learn the pleasures of eating that way and not expect to have the same meal any time of year, regardless of whether it can be sourced from where you live.
Right. And the thing is, I think people also need to really slow up and really pay attention to the flavors. That's
one
of the things
eating, yeah.
What's that?
The mindful eating is a wonderful
exercise.
There's some dinners that the idea is you don't have a conversation about politics while you're eating. You have a conversation about your food and where it came from and how it tastes.
Right. But also, right, the taste is what I was going to get at because, mindfulness and slowing down, we all know about that. But I think in our society, people have, see something and they expect it to taste a certain way, but they don't really pay attention to see whether it really is. And for instance, like a strawberry, I mean, you can see a bright red strawberry and it looks so, like it's going to be so delicious and sweet. And you taste it and people go, oh, these are so great. And then I'll take one, I'll taste it. And I'm going, no, it's not. It doesn't taste like a strawberry at all. It's red, it's cold, it might be juicy, but it's tart. There's no sweetness. It doesn't taste like a strawberry. And people just don't even care about that part.
Yeah.
They just accept these as, oh, these are delicious strawberries, when they're really not. And I think we need to become more discerning in our flavor palette so that we wait for the strawberries to be in season and taste a local strawberry, and then you know what a strawberry is supposed to taste like.
Yeah.
And demand that you only buy a strawberry when it's going to taste like that.
Yeah.
You know, I've gotten into, people should know, like at Whole Foods, if you want to taste it, like I can't tell you how many apples I brought home that then they're organic, but they're gritty or they don't taste that good. You know, you can say, can I taste this apple before I buy it? And they will actually, you know, they all have knives in their back pockets and they'll cut into an apple and give you a taste that you know, okay, these are good apples, I'll buy one.
Yeah.
Because we've just become kind of lazy in our taste buds. We don't demand full flavor, you know?
And that's one of the things that I think the Instagramming side of food culture is kind of leading us a little bit astray. We shouldn't be eating with our eyes. You know, if something is big, that doesn't mean it's tastier. If something is shaped perfectly, that does not mean it's tastier. In fact, usually the opposite. And I think that people are beginning to learn that that small, flavorful things are bigger than these giant things that ship more easily, or that, people now have learned to treasure heirloom tomatoes. You know,
right.
And so suddenly we don't want a big, perfectly shaped, rubbery beefsteak,
tomato.
Wrapped in cellophane, but, you know, all right, so it's got a bump in it and it grows kind of funny and the color's weird. It's still probably going to taste better.
Right, there's a whole movement called ugly fruit, you know, where they're really ugly fruits and vegetables, where they're finding a market for these, and very often they'll sell them for a little bit less, but they're full of flavor and they're harvested, you know, at the time they're supposed to be harvested, and they might not travel as well because they're ripe when they're picked, but they have much more flavor. So, you know, people really need to look for flavor more than the look of it. And I think the same goes for, you know, when we go to some of these fancier restaurants and you get a really small portion that's beautifully, artistically decorated on the plate. Very often, you know, because there's a small portion, it causes you to slow down your eating,
mm-hmm.
and you pay attention to every bite because you really want to savor it and make it last longer. And yet those restaurants really usually are giving you something that has more flavor.
Yeah, and so, the flavor's more concentrated.
Yeah, so it's really an art to do that. You know, it's a pleasure when you can go and take the time and, you know, savor each bite when you really have the flavor.
Yeah.
So,
I think that's a funny thing, then, and this is really kind of on the restaurant industry, is that they had, I don't know where, I'm going to blame the 80s, because why not? That it used to be that you were judged by how much food you were delivering on that plate, and you made your plates bigger and your portions bigger. And you go to Europe, and people are astounded that Americans eat so much, you know, have these big portions, because by the end of it, you don't taste what you're eating anyway. You're just, you know, trying to get it down. So you learn to leave things on your plate, and that creates food waste.
Right.
Which is, and I would prefer to have a much smaller portion and finish it all and enjoy every bite of it and not be jaded by it and not have to throw anything away or feel guilty about that.
Right. And also be able to sample more courses, you know,
yeah.
At least for me. You know, I want to get the salad and the appetizer and the entree and, you know, and then if you're too full for dessert, what fun is that? You know, if you're at a really nice place. So anyway, I agree with you. You know, the smaller portions and really taking the time and tasting everything is just a pleasure in itself. So can you share with us, you know, maybe a few of your favorite stories from your latest anthology?
One thing I want to point out is one of the things that I enjoy is that every one of these books has a beautiful still life photo of food on the front. And I, in my mind, when I, as I've done so many of these, they're beginning to blur together in my mind. So I can't always remember what was in the 2016 book, but I can always remember the one, what was in the one with the butternut squash soup on the cover. I'll say,
right,
in my, the one with the eggs on the cover, right? You were in the one with the eggplant on the cover.
Uh-huh. It's true. But the photographs really add a lot, too.
Yeah. It really pulls you in.
Uh-huh. Now, do you have a hard copy of your book that has photographs, or you don't do the photographs?
No, we don't do photographs, and it's become, it would double the amount of permissions that we have to obtain, and it would also, because these are all pieces that have been published before in some other publication, so we have to take them as they are, and some of them have been published in publications with gorgeous full-color photography, which would enormously increase our production costs and the quality of the food, of the paper that we use. So for us to make that leap, and then we'd have to do it for every piece, and not all of them have equally good artwork. And also what I found is that sometimes you'll read a story that's in a magazine with beautiful photography, and when I strip out the text and have it need to stand on its own as an essay, it's not as good as something else that maybe ran in a newspaper and, you know, the print smudged.
It doesn't have that.
Yeah, and then you realize the story itself is better. So we're really trying to focus on the words here.
Right. Before we get into your favorite stories, let's take just a couple-minute break. And when we come back, I really want to hear some of your favorites so you have a chance
to
look at your...
Right, that'll give me a minute to look through.
Right, exactly, your butternut squash copy one, and share with us from that book.
Okay.
Everyone, don't go anywhere. You're listening to Bhavani at IE Green and my guest, Holly Hughes. Be right back.
Listening to PRN. The Progressive Radio Network. The Progressive Radio Network. The Progressive Radio Network. You're listening to PRN. The Progressive Radio Network. This is the number one radio station for progressive independent thinkers, the Progressive Radio Network.
Welcome back. You're listening to Bhavani at IE Green on the Progressive Radio Network, and I'm here with Holly Hughes, author and editor of a series of food writing books. On the latest one, The Best Food Writing 2016. Holly, you with me?
Yeah, I'm here.
Great. So you had a chance to get your book and share with us a few of your favorite stories from the book?
Yeah. One of the things that I like about that I find in food writing nowadays is it's not trying to prove that you're more sophisticated or cooler than anybody else. And you know, it's just as interesting to write about something like, you know, chicken tenders or nachos as it is to write about the finest meal in a restaurant, because you're still going beyond it and figuring out, why do people eat this? Where did it come from? What does it mean to them? And in that respect, one of my favorite pieces from this year is called "The Case for Bad Coffee." It was published in SeriousEats.com, and it was written by Keith Pandolfi, who's been in the book a few times. And it begins by him saying, you know, that lately all he wants to drink is like Maxwell House coffee. And then he backtracks to tell you, you know, this is kind of odd because he used to work at Starbucks, and he kind of proves his credentials as somebody who knows And coffee culture is its own crazy, rarefied world where people are really into the sourcing of the beans and how you grind and everything else. And so he kind of proves that he's been there and he's done that, and now he finds that it's a little exhausting to try to do that all the time, and sometimes you just want a cup of Maxwell House. But then he takes the story somewhere else and starts talking about the cups of bad coffee that he drank, you know, with his father in coffee shops when he was a young kid, and then going to chain restaurants with his stepfather and having, you know, lingering over a cup of, you know, just kind of mediocre, straight-on American coffee. And it was over those coffee cups that they developed a relationship, and then he learned to respect this man who had entered his life. And it ends with this incredibly poignant thing, and you realize, you know, coffee isn't just coffee. It's who you've drunk it with, and all, you know, and there may be certain class things about it or regional things about it. And it's I think for something as simple as a cup of ordinary coffee, it shows how far you can take a story like that. So I think that's a really wonderful piece that I highly recommend.
Beautiful, yeah.
And another one that I really liked a lot was, and one of the great things for me, a little sidetrack, one of the great things for me is that there's so many regional food publications now that have wonderful writing and that, you know, we don't see because they're not being marketed in our area. So I have the opportunity to help people get to know about wonderful places like, you know, Edible Baja, Arizona, which does incredible stuff in this, you know, this desert food shed down there. And Edible New Orleans, which explores the rich culture of that city. Edible Philadelphia, which has some wonderful stuff. There's a whole host of edibles in the New York area. I could go on and on, but you know, for me, being able to share the work from those regional magazines with a national audience is wonderful. And this wonderful piece by L. Kazimu Harris from Edible New Orleans.
Hold on one second. There's something coming on our line that's really...
Yeah.
Are you hearing it?
Yes.
Okay, there you go. Go ahead now.
So it's something called Yakamane, which was also called Old Sober, something that people in New Orleans would eat.
I remember what you asked.
They would eat, like, you know, to get rid of a hangover or something. But he writes about, you know, some food history, about how it was sourced, you know, the history of how it was developed. It's this odd kind of food. It's not Creole. It's not Chinese. It's not Southern. And how to make it, of course. But he also talks about what it meant to him and how it says something to him about the food of his hometown where he grew up. And I think it's a lovely piece without leaning too hard on the sentiment or anything. It's just, again, about how food means so many things to us because of our experience with it.
Right.
There's also a great piece about gumbo, which was also from SeriousEats.com by Pablo Johnson, about the gumbo that he, how he developed his personal gumbo recipe throughout the years growing up in New Orleans. There's always crazy travel pieces, too, which, you know, the intersection between food and travel is huge. So there's a wonderful piece in The Washingtonian by Todd Kleiman, this almost surrealistic thing about going down to Mexico City to eat tacos and instead drinking mezcal and having a really weird experience.
Yeah, that could get you sidetracked real easily.
He's a fabulous storyteller, so, you know, he really takes you with us on this phantasmagoric journey. And similarly, a piece from Travel and Leisure by Howie Kahn called The Hunger Games, about why Singapore is his favorite dining city. And you know, I tend to be the kind of traveler who likes to slow down and relax, and Howie apparently is not, because he hits the ground running in Singapore, and he has all these connections, and he's meeting with all these food people in Singapore and just eating, 5-6 meals a day, can't get enough of it.
Oh, God.
And it's wonderful to be able to enjoy that with him without having to actually take in all those calories.
I'll tell you, one of the ones that caught my eye was Sorry, Blue Apron, The Joys of Cooking Can't Fit in a Box. I love that one. And, you know, and I think why is partly as a chef, you know, and somebody who cooks all the time, and, you know, one of my biggest passions is trying to
share my passion with people and trying to encourage them to start cooking.
Because I think that's one of the biggest problems in our society is that people aren't cooking, and that, you know, they might be into the trendiness of food fashion, as you said, you know, going out and taking photographs and posting it, but they're still going out and eating, and they're still not really paying attention to where their food's coming from and not supporting the things that, you know, that I'd like to see them supporting. And now there's this big trend of, you know, the meal kits and where they stand. And I just really like this piece, you know, because he talks about how, you know, they can be great to get people going, but hopefully people don't stop there, you know.
Yeah. And because the meal kit doesn't encourage you to experiment or to look at the ingredients that you have and think about combining them in new and different ways. That's why several years ago I read a food history piece about cake mixes. And one of the points they made was that when they started doing cake mixes, they could basically have a powder you just add milk to, stir it up, put it in the oven. And homemakers were resisting that, especially women who were just beginning to go back to work and they needed some shortcuts in the kitchen because they said, it doesn't feel like cooking. I'm used to cooking. And so they backed off and they had the cake mix where you add an egg.
Right.
So that you feel like you're at least handling one real food product, and cracking that into the bowl made you feel like you were cooking. So
right.
I think that the Blue Apron, or not just Blue Apron, any of the meal kits are doing a little bit so you feel like you're cooking, but you're only going so far with it.
Right. Well, it was also funny. He talked about the experience of, you know, they give you pre-measured things, but everything's not supposedly measured. So they'll give you a little packet of salt. But they expect you to do salt to taste, but they don't say that. So someone just dumped the whole salt thing in, and it was unedible.
Right, and everybody has a different seasoning palate. You know, the idea of seasoning to taste is one of the basic things that cooks begin to learn. But.
Right, right. And, you know, and most recipes have you, you know, taste it again and taste it again, and, mm-hmm. you know, so that you are cooking by taste. And, you know, I know as a chef it's always challenging to make a recipe from my dishes because, you know, I don't measure as I'm going when I'm creating something, and then I have to try to backtrack. And
yeah. It's very hard. I do a lot of these clean out the refrigerator type of, I guess you'd call them casseroles, where I just look at what I've got, you know, and I'm going to go to the CSA again in a few days, so I need to start clearing this stuff out. And I think what would go with each other. And, you know, start layering it in, and then I taste it, and I say, you know, what would I need something with a little brighter taste to put in there. What do I have that has brighter taste? You know, and sometimes these are wonderful, and I cook them for a long time, and the foods all kind of are melting into each other, and I think they're delicious. And when I get a really good one, I'll sit back and say, I have no idea what I put in that now. I'll never be able to reproduce this.
Right, right. Of course, I think we've all had that. And so, you know, you try as you go along, but if you do it as you go along, it really kind of takes away from the creative process if you're having to stop and, you know, write it down. Or
right, right.
It's a little annoying, but we do it sometimes anyway, don't we?
Yeah, recipe development. People think it must be a great job, but I think when you finally are doing the fine points of exactly how much to tell somebody else to do to reproduce this, it can get really frustrating.
Now, are you a chef as well, or it's just something you love to do?
No, I am not a trained chef. I've never taken any cooking classes. And I have nothing but great respect for the many food writers who have some culinary training and who actually are fabulous cooks. I'm a home cook, and I am limited sometimes by what my family will eat. They all have their picky things.
Right.
You know, it's putting a meal on the table every day. I have nothing but respect for people who do that because it's not easy.
It's not. And, you know, one of the things that I like to share with people is, you know, I call myself a chef, but I am also not culinary trained. I am self-taught. I am you know, a mom who had to put food on the table every day. Well, actually, I guess a little bit more than that. I did, you know, have a catering company before I had kids, but actually not before, while I had kids. But I did it because it was something that I always could do and having given up eating meat early on, there weren't a lot of vegetarian caterers out there.
Yeah.
So that kind of was my little niche, you know. I was catering to people I knew who were vegetarians, and then word kind of spread. And so that's how I got started. But, you know, I like to share with people that nothing that I'm doing is fancy or something that you couldn't do. And, you know, it's home cooking, and that's what most of us eat every day. And, you know, even the fanciest of chefs, you know, who come home, you know, you ask them what do they cook on a weekday night, or, you know, when they come home for dinner, and it's something simple that their mom used to cook, you know?
Exactly. And that's what's comforting.
Yeah. And so, you know, I go for comfort food a lot because, you know, especially I find a lot of people who are transitioning, trying to make food choices that are more sustainable. And so, you know, trying to cut back on meat or you know, cheese and dairy, that kind of thing. They, you know, still are craving some of their comfort foods. And my little niche has been how to, you know, what things can substitute for those comfort foods, you know, how to make a, you know, a vegan lasagna, you know, and make ricotta cheese out of either a cashew cream or a tofu cream, you know, and yet make it taste good so that you come back for it. You know,
and
because
also, I had a summer when my daughter, I think she was 17, 18, she decided she was going to be vegan. And we have a son with severe tree nut allergies. So none of those substitutes that were dependent on nuts could be used. And I was still trying to cook the same thing for everybody, and maybe I'd have a little more protein for her and then we have the steak that he wanted, whatever. And when she started this, I said, I will not let you do this unless you are willing to go into the worlds of beans and tofu. And even after she kind of backtracked a little and was just vegetarian, I said, you know, you can't do this unless you are willing to eat yogurt and fish. And now she eats fish, too. And she used to be one of those kids who was just chicken nuggets and French fries. And now she eats adventurously. And I know people think she learned to eat adventurously by becoming vegan. Usually that's somebody who cuts down. I said, you know, all you're doing is in your narrower range, you have to expand what you're willing to try. And then you discover new things that you wouldn't have tried anyway.
Right.
She quickly learned that packaged tofurkey didn't taste like turkey. And she didn't really like it, you know, and it looked weird and rubbery. And so she had to learn how to get a piece of tofu and cut it up and put it into a stir fry or something so that she wasn't relying on the packaged foods, because it's the packaging that sometimes completely erases whatever health gains you're trying to get.
Absolutely, and they'll put so much salt in it and so much other stuff that you don't even know what it is. I went to an event last night that was Long Island University at Post is looking into starting up a food sustainability major.
Oh, that's cool.
I was talking to them about that and, you know, saying how, you know, it's great to create a major like that, but you have to realize you can't really have a food sustainability major a standalone thing. You really have to integrate it with your business school and your entrepreneurship and innovation. And because if you're going to have a major like that, what are the graduates going to do? They have to come out. There's not enough jobs that need food sustainability people on their own. You really need to be training kids to go out and create something new with these ideas. And so anyway, they had an event last night and I went, and it was all vegan, and you know, and they were really trying, they did a great job, but some of the desserts were bright colored and I was like, how did that green get that green? And they were like, oh, it's, you know, there's nothing artificial. And I said, I don't believe you. Where's the ingredients? And three different chefs were running around the whole time trying to find something, and they said, oh, well, pistachios. I was like, pistachios are not that green.
Yeah.
You know, so they then disappeared. They never came back to me with an answer, and I'm sure it was artificially colored.
Yeah.
You know, and so very often, you know, just because something's vegan doesn't mean it's healthy, and I think people, or just because it's being sold at Whole Foods doesn't mean it's healthy.
Right.
People really need to look at the ingredients and, you know, and become detectives in a certain sense to find out what the food consists of that they're eating. And especially if you're going out to restaurants a lot, you either need to really research the restaurant and choose a restaurant that you can trust where they're getting their products from, or, you know, or assume that you're eating garbage if you're going to a, you know, a cheap fast food type of restaurant.
Right. Right. Yeah, and I think it's easy for me. I mean, that's again the dogma, whether it's the locavore dogma or the organic dogma. You need to always take this with a pinch of salt. I also think it's important for people to know I cook for myself in a healthy manner, a sustainable manner, and every once in a while I want to go out and have a lavish dinner where I'll, you know, my daughter's pediatrician said to her, fine, be a vegetarian, that's great, you know, be conscious about it. And if someday you wake up craving a hamburger, let yourself have it because your body is telling you that you're iron deficient. And you know, to get that from meat rather than a vitamin when you're 17 years old and still growing is probably a reasonable thing. But I know some great food writers who say, you know, every once in a while I just want to go to McDonald's.
Mm-hmm.
Just first of all to find out what people are eating, and also because, you know, you have to be able to let yourself down a little bit every once in a while.
Right, right. You know, but that's one of the things that is one, for as much as I don't love that McDonald's is, you know, exists, period. The fact that they are now catching on, that people are caring about their food sourcing a little bit more.
Yeah.
I mean, McDonald's has made a pledge to start sourcing meat that is antibiotic-free and hormone-free.
Yeah, I think that is fabulous.
Exactly, exactly, because right now there's not enough meat being raised that's hormone-free and antibiotic-free. So just the fact that a McDonald's is saying they want to do that is going to necessitate farmers to transition to become antibiotic-free and hormone-free, which is better for everybody.
Yeah, I think it's fabulous to put market pressure on them.
Yeah, exactly. You know, and only the public can do that. So that's why, you know, when I started my show at the beginning, I said, everyone, we've got to take to the streets. We have the power in numbers to make the changes that we want to see happen. We don't have the money to fight against, you know, the Monsantos of the world, but
we
have people
opinion.
Power.
Yeah. And I think that's
nice
one of the
that
things
happening.
That I've found in the course of editing this book since the year 2000, more and more really serious, hard-hitting journalists have decided that food issues are things that they want to pursue. And by giving them a platform in my book, I'm raising all these, you know, allowing people to read about all these issues, and they have to go side by side with the lovely piece about your grandmother's cookies and the, you know, ecstatic piece about the wonderful meal you ate at this fancy restaurant, because it is all tied together.
It is. And on that note, we're going to have to wrap it up, but Holly, can you just quickly share with everybody your website so people can find you and order your book?
Which is like a guilty reminder that I need to update the bookstore section of that. Hughes, no periods are in it, .net. And then there's also the website for Best Food Writing, which is bestfoodwritingbook.com.
Great. And the links are on my website, too, everyone. So if you don't remember that, didn't write it down fast enough, you can always find it on my website. Holly, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thanks so
and
much,
everyone
Bonnie.
Out there.
It's been a fun conversation.
Thank you. And everyone out there, thank you for joining me, and I'll see you all again next week. Hope to see you at the march. Bye for now.